at this point of time, it's Ukraine is caught between the devil and the deep sea, as we say. And it's like a political chessboard where ordinary Ukrainians are playing for some game which is being decided somewhere else. So a war is being funded with debt.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Welcome, everyone, to Resisting the Shock Doctrine, Ukraine Debt and Reconstruction. My name is Ashley Smith. We have a very important panel today that addresses Ukraine's struggle against debt and neoliberalism. So as everybody has been following, in the midst of Russia's imperialist war, Ukraine's left, unions, and popular movements have struggled to cancel their country's debt held by international financial institutions and also resist Vladimir Zelensky's neoliberal policies. Already, the IMF has attached conditionalities to new loans to Ukraine, setting an ominous precedent for its reconstruction. We have a wonderful list of speakers today, featuring Yulia Yurchenko, Eric Toussaint, Sushovan Dar. They'll try and contextualize Ukraine's struggle as part of the global movement against neoliberalism and debt. Yulia Yurchenko is a senior lecturer in political economy at the Department of Accountancy, Finance, and Economics, and a researcher at the Political Economy, Governance, Finance, and Accountability Institute at the University of Greenwich in the UK. She is author of Ukraine and the Empire of Capital. Eric Toussaint is a historian and political scientist who completed his PhD at the University of Paris 8, and Liege, I'm sorry for mispronouncing anything, and he is the spokesperson for the Committee for the Abolition of Illegitimate Debt and sits on the Scientific Council of Attac in France, and he is the author of The Debt System, as well as many other books. Sushovan Dar is a political activist and trade unionist based in Kolkata, India. He is involved in debt cancellation campaigns and is the International Council member of the Committee for the Abolition of Illegitimate Debt and is on the advisory group of the South Asia Alliance for Poverty Eradication and vice president of the Progressive Plantation Workers Union. Each of our speakers will speak for about 8 to 10 minutes, followed by a discussion and questions and posed from our audience. But before I hand it over to Yulia, I wanted to just also note that this event is being put on by the Ukraine Solidarity Network in the U.S. and is co-hosted by Haymarket Books. So thanks to both those organizations. So Yulia, let's start with you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me here. Can you hear me okay? Yeah, I'm plugging in here from Krakow train station, just en route from Ukraine, where I've spent the last 2 weeks talking with activists and trade unionists and meeting friends and family and comrades, and firsthand witnessing the difficulties, to put it mildly, that the country is experiencing, as is evidenced in individual stories of people, because those are usually the most telling ones. Macroeconomic figures very often conceal a lot of the detail and nuance that is most important in how countries fare in difficult times. This event about reconstruction and about debt is very important because in the case of Ukraine, there is a law that is quite unique, for example, but there is a law that is quite expected and quite omnipresent in the global political economy. And historically, we have seen a lot of cases where countries riddled by wars and various other crises are being further depleted and alienated in their agency by debt servitude. So in Ukraine's case, for example, the historical conditional relationship with EU and Western partners and Russia specifically, both economic and geopolitical, had also this debt dimension, including trade areas, import and export dependencies. And debt was used as an instrument of external control and expropriation of national wealth, combined with national system of taxation and trade regimes that in that kind of case is used as a powerful diluter in the decision-making autonomy that's fundamental to any meaningful exercise of political sovereignty. In Marx's words, debt leads to alienation of the state, and that in that sense, national states cease to be autonomous agents of authority that is representative of its people. So even if the most well-meaning people come to power, which is still a matter of time and matter of question, we do not know, they will be in the straitjacket of debt conditionality, and the economy will be economically paralyzed by the need to prioritize repayment of debts and interest and debts, rather than prioritizing the needs of its people, the most dire needs indeed. We have seen the dispensation of multiple rapid financing instruments. There were some grants, but overwhelmingly there have been loans. And of course, the IMF loans are infamously riddled with very complex conditionality that also ironically goes against their own current thinking that austerity, for example, doesn't lead to growth, that cuts to public spending don't lead to growth and recovery. They understand it, yet they ascribe even more and more and more conditionality. So we see that, you know, even the hardcore economic logic and numbers are not good enough to convince the ideological mission of perpetuating the class project of expropriation through international institutions in the name of the transnational capital that we see globally. And indeed, even if Ukraine's case with the Russo-Ukrainian war, of course, and with the blackmail around nuclear weapons hanging over the situation, even that is not convincing enough for the IMF and for the private lenders, indeed, specifically, to write off the debts for Ukraine. And we on this call, I assume, all understand why exactly that is. That is, IMF and the private lenders do not need to create the proceedings, because there is a very long queue of countries who are equally entitled to debt, to their debts being written off because of the conditions that I have already highlighted. Eric will go deeper into the question of debt as well, but now I want to switch and the second part of my presentation to the recovery planning that is on the table for Ukraine. And I'm involved in organizing a number of alternative parallel events to the London Recovery Conference that will take place in June in London. Last year in Lugano, in Switzerland, there was this first Ukraine Recovery Conference, post-war recovery conference, and it had very amazing aims, right? So it was agreed between different international partners and Ukrainian officials that there needs to be a new institutional architecture for smart recovery of infrastructure, economy, environment, and society, and it should all be done on the principles of partnership, reform focus, transparency, accountability, and the rule of law, democratic participation, multi-stakeholder engagement, gender equality, inclusion, and sustainability. Sounds fantastic, and it is as ephemeral and watered down as it is big and promising. Once you start looking into how these big aims are supposed to be achieved, you begin to understand that the means do not match the ends. So, for example, gender equality and inclusion cannot be achieved, but at the same time, cuts to social funding, cuts to healthcare, cuts to education, cuts to social reproduction function of the state are being done. On top of that, lots of kindergartens, for example, and schools have been bombed, and their rebuilding is being proposed to be done by attracting private investors by attracting private investors to build this some sort of fancy buildings. And it is not a very cost-effective way of reconstructing anything. On top of that, there is a big fundamental miss, and that initial plan was assessed to potentially cost $750 billion. Many said that it would be quite a lot. Indeed, it would be significantly more. A lot of it depends on how you count, but indeed, even the full scale and scope of destruction by now is not accurately known, and until the war is over, it is impossible to know it. But the one of the big things that is missing in this big plan is the human being at the center of the recovery. Some 12 million people are now listed as refugees. Those who are in Russia and Belarus are listed as refugees. It's a problematic use of the term, but they have been displaced in some form to those countries, very, very often by force or by having no other choice. But the point is that those people have left the country. They were forced to leave the country by the conditions of the war. Overwhelmingly, especially those who went to countries other than Belarus and Russia, are women, children, and the elderly. Often, and men of some person, men of conscription age were not allowed to leave the country unless exempt. So we have this demographic displacement and catastrophe on our hands. And there is a whole host of professions, especially in the social reproduction function of the state, in the care economy, that are usually on the shoulders of women. It's not unique to Ukraine situation, but in Ukraine especially, it has been quite pronounced. So if we are imagining that in this recovery plan, there is prioritization of market-based economic recovery, attracting private investment, and cuts to social spending, there is nothing in that plan that could provide social architecture and financing that would allow for women and children to come back. There is very little being put, there is no conversation about social housing program. And indeed, when you have complete depletion of job opportunities, when people don't have employment sources, they do not have kindergartens, child care, also different services, where will they come back to? And how will they be enabled to participate in paid employment? It is simply impossible. There is that one central thing. There is this assumption that people will come back and rebuild. I've already spoken to a number of trade unionists in Ukraine, and they're saying that they're losing cadre, and they're losing those who could be training new ones. And it's in key industries, in construction, in healthcare, in those sectors that are the backbone of every economy. This whole talk about IT sector being the pivot of reconstruction. Well, you know, it's all good, all this IT stuff, but who's going to be cleaning the floors? Who's going to be doing the piping? Who's going to be changing the electric wires? That is much more. Those people are not. There is nothing created for them to come back. On top of that, the labor codes and labor rights enshrined in the code have been depleted completely over the last year. Some 70% workforce have lost their rights to employment and social protection in the last summer. The minimum wage is at 6,700. Ukrainian hryvnias, which was high inflation and devaluation of currency, gets you absolutely nowhere. There are some projections by IMF and some economic institutes, neoclassical, neoliberal institutes in Ukraine, that are saying that, you know, there are quite a few jobs being created in Ukraine. Well, people I speak to can't find jobs, so I'm not sure where those jobs are created. But yeah, and on top of that, there are those, again, 12 million people plus who are abroad. Where will there be jobs for them? You know, so those the scope and the scale of the recovery would be absolutely fundamental. And this principle would be absolutely fantastic and grand in their scale. And for that, Ukraine will need a lot of money. It will need grants. And there is a lot of talk about the Marshall Plan, and I'm going to finish with that. But the main lessons from the Marshall Plan, I did not see reflected in these recovery plans. First of all, there was a write-off of debts. Second of all, there were grants given to countries, and there was recipient in the country, countries were allowed states were allowed to act as investors and were allowed to directly buy food for families, buy supplies for industries. That is not in Ukraine. All we hear is part of this talk in the build up to the London conference is that we need to attract private investment to come to the country. Private investors will not go into the country where there is still war. It's, you don't need to be on Wall Street to know that. So there is war, but there is no wartime economy. There is no nationalization of key industries. In deprivatization keeps happening. So there are lots and lots and lots of problems. And on top of that, of course, there is overwhelming accumulation of debt through rapid financing instruments, through bond selling, and of course, there is also household debt. People have maxed out their credit cards, right, and borrowed from friends and relatives. That also needs to be talked about, but I will leave Eric to discuss those issues. There is lots to cover, but I've already spoken for too long, and I look forward to questions.
Thank you so much, Yulia, and thank you again for joining us from the train station in Krakow. It's like you're an activist scholar on the move, and we're very thankful to have your participation. So I'll turn it over to Eric. Eric, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. Very happy to be with you today. Of course, Ukrainian external and internal debt should be cancelled. Should be abolished. They are illegitimate, odious debt. It was already the case before the invasion of Ukraine. The debt accumulated after the independence was accumulated, contracted to finance the neoliberal policies against the interest of the people of Ukraine. If we look now to the level of the debt, apparently, since the beginning of the war, the debt had not really increased a lot at the level of the figure. At the beginning of the war, it was said that the debt, external debt of Ukraine, was something like $130 billion. Now it is $132 billion, but I said it's apparent because in reality, a big part of the financial assistance given to Ukraine is in the form of debt. So the help supposedly given by the IMF, $15 billion, following an agreement signed in March 2023, which prolonged another agreement before, it's $15 billion debt. And because this debt is much more important than the quota of Ukraine inside the IMF, the interest rate on this debt will be something like 7 or 8% interest rate. And of course, the IMF financial assistant, as Julia told us, is directly linked with the prolongation of neoliberal policies, more privatization, legal changes to open more the economy to foreign investment and foreign interest. I have to add immediately the financial assistance coming from the European Union. It's something like, it is announced like something 30 billion euros. It is not been already disbursed. Something like 10 billion has been disbursed to the Ukrainian government, and it's debt. What the European Union is doing with Ukraine is what they did with Greece after 2010. The European Union made an agreement in 2010 with the IMF to gather money to give to the Greek government with very strong and brutal conditionalities. And that's exactly what the European Union, the European Commission is reproducing with the type of assistance given to Ukraine. And it is, the two things are linked. If you read the agreement signed by the Ukraine government with the IMF, it is said that this agreement is given with the conditionality to improve structural reforms to allow the country to integrate the European Union. So the European Union, the European Commission, and the IMF will impose to Ukraine different type of policies in the interest of the European Western European capitalist, and at the as a condition to integrate the European Union. At the level of the USA, as Julia said, the USA are given grants to Ukraine. They are implementing what they did with the Marshall Plan at the end of the years 1940s with the rebuilding of the European economies allied with the USA during the Cold War, because the US understood that it's better for its economy to give grants. But the grants are also linked with conditionalities. They ask the Ukrainian government to open the space in the Ukrainian economy for U.S. interest. And the U.S. is given grants, but as the IMF is a tool totally controlled by the U.S., with the European, and because the financial assistance given by the IMF is consisted in debt, the USA will use the conditionality of the imposed by the IMF in favor of the interest of the US capitalist. So the debt trap for Ukraine is very dangerous, because I would say with the new financial assistance given to Ukraine in the next year, in the 10 next year, the debt will increase with something like $40 billion. So from $132 billion to $170 billion. And the creditors know perfectly that it will be impossible for Ukraine to pay back all this debt. So what is happening? They decided, the main creditors decided in July 2022 to authorize the Ukraine government to suspend the payment. And they decided in October 2023 to prolong the suspension until 2027. So they imagine more or less that maybe the war will end around this period. And knowing that it will be impossible to Ukraine really to pay back the debt, they will use this debt and the negotiation around the restructuration of the debt, and to give some alleviation of the debt, maybe 20 billion, maybe 40 billion, alleviation of the debt, but with more conditionalities. So that they try to increase importantly the debt to have more power of blackmail on the Ukraine government and the population of Ukraine to impose more and more neoliberal policies in the interest of the capitalist classes, Western capitalist classes. In this debate, China, which is a creditor, Turkey, which is also in some way a creditor, will negotiate with the Western powers, and they will try to have a part of what will be given to the creditors. So, because China is a creditor, China is part of the IMF and the World Bank with 6% of the votes. And so they will condition the agreement for some alleviation given by other creditors. They will condition the participation in change for some concession in favor of China, and China is very interested by the project of the Silk Road, which passed through Russia or through Ukraine, and the problem of the gas export, etc., is part of the problem, and the question of privatizing the big public corporation, Ukrainian corporation on gas, it's also a priority for the IMF and the Western creditors. So we have to understand that the question of the debt will be in some way at the center of the negotiation in the next years, as the title of the conference is telling, as an instrument to impose more shock therapy. It's not to initiate, no, it's not to begin with shock therapy. The shock therapy already happened in the 1990s and in the 2000s, but it will be, it will make the situation more difficult for the people of Ukraine. So we should say that the suspension of payment is not a solution. The full cancellation of the debt reclaimed to Ukraine, it's a real solution, of course, linked to other policies. And so, and at this level, it is clear that the Zelensky government is a right-wing government, is a neoliberal government, is in favor of debt, of that they want to make happy the creditors, including selling domestic bonds to domestic creditors and oligarch and rich of the Ukrainian population. So, for us, it's an alternative program to the neoliberal program. Cancellation of the debt, but with socialization of the big medal of production, socialization, expropriation of the banking sector, and a fiscal structural reform in favor of the poorest, the popular classes of the country, to finance in another way, not with external debt, a real development, human development, and reconstruction for Ukraine. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Eric, and thanks for all the work and activism that you've been leading for years as part of the struggle against debt all over the world, especially in the global south. On that topic, we'll turn it over to Sushovan to talk about how Ukraine's struggle fits into the broader struggle against debt and sovereign debt crises throughout the world. So, Sushovan, take it away.
Thank you, Ashley. In fact, I just would start by saying that, by mentioning that Ukraine, when it became independent in 1991, it did not inherit any debt from the Soviet Union. It was a debt-free country at its birth. But you know, over a period of time, there has been such an accumulation of debt, which makes it at the top tier of countries plagued by the debt crisis at this point of time. For example, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Zambia, Ghana, you know, it's the country, it's just defaulted and nothing, no other ways but to default. Secondly, much, even if not the entire part of the debt, but a very large part of the debt is illegitimate. And a large part is odious because it was borrowed, as my previous speakers, both Yulia and Eric, that explained the economic mechanisms, what happened with the oligarchs and how debt was used, what were the conditionalities. So much of the part of the debt, much of the part of the money that was borrowed was against the interest of the population, for which the population has to pay. So it perfectly fits in the category of having a very high portion of illegitimate debt and a very high portion of quite a good amount of odious debt. Now, if you look into it, you know, this forms the very basis of our demand for the cancellation of the debt. Ukraine is at war. It's in a formal war. So it's a little different situation from many other countries which are at default. Many other countries which is going to be in default very soon. But even then, I mean, the indicators, basically, it's one of the poorest countries of Europe. And look at the conditions. I mean, leave everything apart. The falling, the great humanitarian crisis, the number of refugees. It's an enormous number of people. You know, it's 8.2 million people who are refugees outside. 5.4 million are internally displaced people. 5.6 million people are returnees. These are current figures from the United Nations, UNHCR figures. Now, to resettle them, to reinstate their livelihood, to reinstate income opportunities, to reinstate a sort of a dignified life, a minimum basic dignified life, would be an enormous challenge. And therefore, much of this debt is unsustainable. And I repeat once again, it is illegitimate and odious. So there's a requirement. I mean, at the same time, there's, I mean, at this point of time, it's Ukraine is caught between the devil and the deep sea, as we say. And it's like a political chessboard, but ordinary Ukrainians are playing, are paying for the for some game which has been, you know, which is being decided somewhere else. So a war is being funded with debt. Now, what we have at the end, a war is being funded with debt. And so much so that the economists, you know, all of us know what economists and what do they stand for. They were cautioning that what is the sustainability of this money being pumped into Europe, Ukraine? They were looking, certainly they were not speaking on behalf of poor ordinary Ukrainians, the Ukrainian working classes. But you're looking at the capitalist stability and how much of the money that you are pumping inside Ukraine, where do you get this money out of? I mean, so as Eric said, that they're looking at 2027, assuming that the war would end sometimes there. We don't know, really know. The light appears too distant. There's no light at the end of the tunnel as of now. But, you know, even if it ends in 2027, the economist, the subtext tries to tell us that there is not enough resources in Ukraine to be sold and paid for this debt. So it's going out of dangerous proportions, and unfortunately, ordinary Ukrainians have to pay for it. They're already paying for it, and they have to pay for it. Much of the debt was accumulated during the periods of chaotic and a sort of an irresponsible borrowing by the oligarchs, much to fund these whole neoliberal changes, the whole privatization, the whole looting of the country, which already has made the lives miserable. So therefore, the Ukrainian debt, we must demand for an international audit of the Ukrainian debt, because, you know, in certain war situations, you don't find an active civil society as you find in many other parts of the world, which is not in a formal war. So therefore, we demand that there must be an audit of the Ukrainian debt, followed by a repudiation, unilateral repudiation of those portion of the debt that is illegitimate and odious. Of course, it has to do with, it should be combined with many factors. You know, the cancellation of debt is also conditional with, of course, the question of restoration of political democracy and restoration of political democracy in all senses, and also the question restoration of economic democracy. I think Yulia, in one of the interviews in some places earlier, was saying that in one of the podcasts I heard that, you know, how the oligarchs, they completely control the country, both the economy and politics. I mean, capitalism teaches us that there's a separation between the politics and the economics, but in Ukraine, you see it merged between one. So politics, it's a typical society. Maybe we need a newer analysis to define cases like Ukraine, where your political and economic authority is merged into one. So much of this reforms, we demand much of this reforms. We demand a meaningful and dignified life for the ordinary Ukrainian people. No to loans, any sort of a humanitarian assistance or grant for the Ukrainian people, restoring their occupations, withdrawal of a number of black laws, especially, it's very difficult to unionize in the Ukraine. There are lots of jobs. The minimum wages are at horrible level. Inflation is, skyrocketing like anything. And on top of this, the labor reforms that the Ukrainian Zelensky government has done, it makes very difficult for unionization. So restoration of rights, all sorts of rights for the people of Ukraine. So that's where it stands. In fact, this demand, I think, should be picked up as part of Ukrainian solidarity around globally. Very soon, sooner or later, I think we are going to come to another debt crisis in some years. I can't predict at this point of time whether 2 years, 5 years, or 10 years. But you already see countries falling like cards, a pack of cards. First is for Sri Lanka, which defaulted, Zambia, which has defaulted, Pakistan, which is in a very bad state. Coming from South Asia, we know all our neighbors. Bangladesh is the latest one to actually having a precarious balance of payment system. So all these are combined. The struggle against all the sorts of illegitimate and odious debt is part of a common and united struggle for a dream for a better world, for a transformative agenda. And for a transformative agenda, I think the cancellation of debt should be one of the major demands, along with many other demands that we have been able to say. I end at this point, and I look forward to questions from the moderators and the audience.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Ireland, Colonialism, and the Unfinished Revolution, by Robbie McVeigh and Bill Ralston. In this groundbreaking examination of the colonial legacy and future of Ireland, McVeigh and Ralston convincingly show that understanding Ireland's experience must be central to grasping the history of colonization and anti-colonial politics throughout the world. Part history, part analysis, this book compellingly charts the centuries of Irish colonial history and explores possibilities for the completion of the decolonization project today. As Barbara Ransby puts it, this book brilliantly analyzes the history and legacy of colonialism and resistance in Ireland and beyond. In this moment where the whole planet is in flux, this powerful account offers indispensable insights for us all. Find Ireland, Colonialism, and the Unfinished Revolution at haymarketbooks.org.
Thank you so much, Sushivan, and it's extremely important to have such a forthright expression of solidarity with Ukraine from Global South activists, given the debate that's gone on throughout the world. I just want to give some time for any of our panelists to respond to one another about the points that were made. So maybe start with Yulia. Go ahead, Yulia.
Thank you very much, Ashley. Thank you, Eric, and thank you, Sushivan. Excellent points, and indeed the situation is catastrophic and quite dangerous, I would say, because we all know that any regime of accumulation has its limits, and any class tensions have their limits. And in Ukraine, we thought that those limits had been reached in 2014, and they have been partially displaced by the contingency of Russian invasion. But now the situation is at such a boiling point that there are so many people with arms in their hands, and they're being further expropriated, that I do fear the worst possible scenario of indeed an internal armed conflict. But let's put that aside for a minute. Coming back to these various debts and conditionalities, I just wanted to add a couple of points. So, Sushovant has mentioned that also that you know, that both Ukrainian politicians and international advisors are not working for the working people of Ukraine. I want to add that they are not working for domestic industry either. There is nothing being done to prioritize domestic producers. How are you going to get recovery going if you're okay giving the green light to foreign investors with no conditions for protecting workers, working conditions, giving proper salaries, health and safety at work, pension contributions, or environmental standards indeed? You cannot, if you do not nourish, if you do not nurture domestic industry, you cannot have stability of growth. It's simple as that. So it's almost self-defeating. Like, you know, these the party of the servants of the people, as I call them, the collective Zelenskys, because it's Zelensky and his party. You know, they continue the doctrine that the oligarch, what I call neoliberal kleptocracy regime, had instilled. And even if you know, during the Yanukovych's reign, there were many industrialists and oligarchs in the government already themselves, and they had purchased MPs and parties. By now, there is a whole cadre created that executes this neoliberal doctrine without even being told to do it. They believe that deregulation will instill something fantastic in the country. Of course, they still get the cut and they get paid to vote in a certain way. Not all of them, but some certainly do. And I know that's a good authority. But, you know, that doesn't mean that there are no decent MPs. But there are many who truly are. There was like this whole cadre, not just in the parliament, throughout the country, of experts and analysts, nurture managers, who think that libertarianist marketeering will bring prosperity to the country. And it simply doesn't work like that. And that is also where the danger is, because replacing the cadre without replacing the ideology will not really help save the country. It really won't. On the debt and the accumulation of debt and the the energy enterprises, the kind of the further plunder of natural resources of Ukraine. There have already been conversations between the state gas and oil company and companies like Burisma and Halliburton about shale gas and about fracking. Ukraine has lots of shale gas. And where they discuss potential exploration is the bed of the Black Sea, is the Carpathian Mountains, and the northeast of the country that is densely populated. And you think about it, and you look at that, and then you look at these sustainability principles that are proclaimed in the recovery plan, and you can't help but wonder why. How come these reformers, like, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, how do they not see the contradictions in this? Even if we are to assume that there is no ill play, there are contradictions constantly. The declared vision and the declared mission, and then the means through which it is supposed to be executed, are in complete contradiction. Another thing I've learned that kind of skipped my mind, and it was pushed to the parliament in the first reading when I was in Ukraine, is that there's been a law pushed through the parliament that would make it easier to bring foreign workers into the country. And my fear here, and it was passed in the first reading, there will be second reading in committee and all that sort of stuff. And I really hope that it will get rebuked. Because all of the different industrialists and the domestic and foreign understand that there will be problem with labor force. But there is also the reserve army of labor, of refugees, of the destituted, who many politicians in richer countries, including the country where I live, UK, want to get rid of. We already know about concentration camps of refugees in Turkey. I fear that, and not only in Turkey, but I fear that this is, you know, instead of Britain, for example, shipping refugees to Rwanda, they will ship them to some sort of mining region of some metal ore or lithium in Ukraine. Why not? Right? On extortionate conditions. This is the kind of dystopian vision that we really need to fight against. They'll stop that.
Thank you much so much, Yulia. Eric, do you have any questions or comments?
Maybe to say that we should question, of course, the policy of our Western government. It's clear that they are in favor of a proxy war. They are using the territory of Ukraine with this war. Of course, the Ukrainian population has the right to resist, and we support the right to resist, of course. But it is clear that the help given by the Western countries is to defend their own imperialist interest. And we should oppose the imperialist interest and the imperialist policy of the Western countries, as we oppose totally the aggression from the Russian imperialist and capitalist, which is a imperialist and capitalist country, too. I have to say that we have to question and to ask question to our parliamentaries, etc., in Europe, for instance, because it is not clear at what condition the weapons sent to Ukraine, what are the conditions? Yeah, it seemed that a part of that will increase the debt reclaimed to Ukraine. A part is grants, but it is not. There is some transparency which is needed, and we have to struggle on that question. And we have to struggle in Europe again, the fact that they are using the pretext of the war to increase importantly the military expenses and to update the military material, and they have very huge interest, not only U.S. corporations who are producing weapons, but German and French and U.K. corporations who are producing and selling weapons to their government, which afterward is given to Ukraine, or which replace what is given as weapon to Ukraine. Another thing I want to underline, linked to the Global South. The OECD published the official figures of the official development aid. You know, that's what the officially the North is giving to the Global South. And they are now calculating the cost of helping the Ukrainian refugee as part of the official development aid to the Global South. And if you see the figures, you will see that the help given to Africa last year was reduced by 10%. But the overall ODA, official debt, official development aid, increased because of the expenses made in Europe, because the expenses are made in Europe, in Poland, in Moldavia, in Belgium. And it's important, of course, to welcome refugees from Ukraine. But clearly, it's not a financial aid given to the Global South. These expenses are down for inside the global North economy, and so we have also to denounce this situation, because of course at the left in Europe, when we see that the government are making a lot of noise about the Ukrainian refugees, and at the same time are for Biden, the people who want to come from Africa to enter the European Union, it's a very a strong scandal. We have to denounce also that question, and to denounce Europe as a fortress. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Sushivan, do you have any comments or questions back to the other panelists?
Yeah, just a few things. I mean, we must have the slogan of no more debt to fund a war. That's number one. Number two, I mean, much of the figures, I mean, Eric has already mentioned that, you know, before the war, Ukrainian foreign debt stood at $132 billion, and currently it's at $132 billion. So, if you look at it, apparently there's not much change. But much of the debt that Ukraine has contracted over this period of time is all hidden. One is last November, I believe, the European Union announced with great fanfare that there's an 18 billion euros package to help out Ukraine. It's all in loans. Number two, the IMF loans, which are deferred till 27, but it's not a cancellation. Secondly, they'll charge the interest. They'll charge interest and interest over interest for the remaining period. So that's not going to be waived. Number three, there's some notorious thing called surcharges in pending IMF loans. Basically, IMF loans, which are 187.5% over the quota of the country, attract surcharge. I mean, on the interest, it's 200 basis point on the interest, pending interest. And also, there's also a time, if it's a time deferred, for example, between 36 to 51 weeks, depending on the type of credit, it attracts a certain surcharge, now, which is around 100 basis point. So you look at the 200 basis point and 100 basis point, and then you have it, the loans which are at 8%, effectively 8%. So it's going to increase the cost of the loans. It's going to add on interest on the loans, maybe till, if we assume, technically at this point of time till 2027, this is going to come as a huge debt at a later period of time. It's a time bomb. It's a time bomb ticking. I mean, it's not a time bomb. It's an atom bomb ticking. We don't know what will be the consequences. Therefore, the Economist was warning the whole capitalist establishment about this management of Ukrainian debt. So, these are issues that require serious attention. These are issues that require wider publicity, because not many people around the world, even if they are in solidarity with the Ukrainian population, has much of an idea into it. Because as you know, finances, much of it is shrouded in mystery and technicalities. That's what the tyranny of finance is. Which looks very technical and a matter for experts, but it's nothing for experts. It's very simple. So the interest cost, there's interest and interest, there's surcharges, what they call it, very fancy name, surcharges and things of that sort, is going to increase the debt to a level, and we must be at the forefront of campaigning against it.
Thank you, Sushivan. Just an encouragement to people in the audience, if you have questions, please put them in the chat and we'll get to as many of them as we can. I just had a question that I wanted to pose mainly to Yulia, because you spoke earlier about the human cost of this, the real impact that often the discussions get so technical around debt and reconstruction that they can disguise what this will mean for regular people. So can you just talk about what impact this is going to have on working class people, oppressed groups, in particular women, LGBT, migrants, et cetera, within Ukraine, the impact of these kinds of odious debt terms and the kind of very neoliberal plans for reconstruction. What will it mean for the Ukrainian people?
Thank you, Ashley. It will mean a continuation of the humanitarian catastrophe, but with the prism of responsabilization. And we have seen that it's also part of the neoliberal doctrine, responsabilization for your own misfortunes, which in fact are created by the systems that serve capitalist accumulation and not basic human needs. So again, depletion of funding to all sorts of social reproductive functions of the state, from education to healthcare to care services. I anticipate the new attacks on the Ukrainian rail to try to privatize them, and the fact that the enterprise was not privatized but functioned as one centralized organism because it was key in helping evacuate people, in helping bring supplies, ammunition to the front, but also food and medical supplies. I live in Britain where rail used to be nationalized, and then it was privatized and broken into pieces. And I was watching what was happening in Ukraine, I was thinking before what it could look like if that was were to happen a few years ago in Ukraine, because I know how bad UK trains are. But for average people, it will mean even further, even more people moving beyond the poverty line. It means even further feminization of poverty. It means that there is a whole segment of population that are now, there are people who are physically and mentally being traumatized in very severe forms. And there is nothing beyond volunteers and various international organizations such as Red Cross, for example, who are providing them with assistance, again, in these like recovery plans, but also in the, right now in the current phase of, as the classic liquidation of effects of the war. If it were not for concrete people pooling together and volunteering and providing help in any sort of way, any sort of form, from evacuating animals to bringing insulin to the villages in the front lines where there are people with disabilities who simply did not want to evacuate, but there was no one to look after them, that was not organized by the state. And if in the conditions of war, those people are left to the mercy and grace of the strangers, imagine what is going to happen when it is all over. And supposedly the economy is booming and it's all your fault. But what I've seen is also, just like with Ukrainian politicians, there is, with average people, there is this internationalization of responsibility for our own problems, which indeed, you know, you and I understand that they are systemic problems and they shouldn't be an individual's fault. So it's not, especially if your problems are the result of a war, you know, such as you maxing out your credit card because the inflation is high and you need to feed your kids and there is no work for you. A lot of people don't want to evacuate from frontline areas because they have nowhere to go. And there is no guarantee that they will have somewhere to stay. There is no guarantee that they will have financial support to buy basics like bed linen and, you know, crockery and that sort of stuff. And at home, even if they live under shelling, they still have some basic comforts. And that is terrifying. Like, as I've also, it's one of the things I'm trying to calculate, but it's very difficult to find complete numbers on, is the kind of percentage of, like, the size of the budgetary hole that is now compensated for by donations and free work that people, that volunteers at home and abroad are supplying. Because it is not just bilateral or international assistance to Ukraine. So I'm just going to stand up because the sun is straightening up. It's not just individual countries or big foundations. It's lots of small donations from, you know, $1 to a couple of thousand, whoever has whatever budgetary availabilities. And that is not something that will permanently last. When I see this, you know, budgetary planning and negotiations about debt restructuring with IMF, it is somehow assumed that that hole in the budget has been plugged by donations and volunteers, as if it is always going to be there. Because I can't see numbers for that. I do not see Ukrainian government talking to IMF or World Bank or EBRD about that which, if donations and free work ceases, is simply going to fall apart. And that is also another very highly risky factor. And we see it from the interviews and from the reports of various non-governmental organizations, the DO and volunteer organizations, that donations are drying up. And the goodwill of people is drying up. And, you know, that kind of wave of initial support that we have seen towards Ukrainians at the beginning is also not quite there anymore, not in the same form and at the same level. In the host countries across the EU and elsewhere, we also see the cost of living crisis. We see governments locally blaming this war for high energy prices, which we know have much more to do with privatized extortionate rates that energy companies are imposing, rather than with anything else. But that is happening, and what it results in is xenophobia. What it results in is social tensions, and, you know, an average human being who sees that refugees are getting something that they are not getting, they start getting resentful. And I do not judge them for that, but I do know that the problem lies elsewhere. And without a serious redistribution, without bringing under public control of key industries at the very least, in Ukraine and elsewhere, we are going to have more of these tensions internationally. We're going to have more wars, and we're going to have more hatred and further strengthening of far-right and outright fascist, Nazi political forces coming to the front. Because that is also something that we learn from history, but also we see around us. We don't even need history books. We see what is happening. And for to stop that, we need fundamental redistribution and seizing of assets that should have never been in private hands back into our control. So we have literally a chance of having a planet to live on. In the middle of the war in Ukraine, for example, the biggest energy distribution company, supply company, DTEC, owned by Renata Khmetov, the biggest oligarch, are still talking about bringing the energy prices back to the international market level. That's the enterprise that should have never been privatized in the first place, because even according to the current heavily watered down legislation about privatization of state assets, industries that are key, such as energy, are supposed to be exempt from privatization. All of these industries have been privatized in contradiction with current legislation. And therefore, there is also a legal case to bring them without, you don't even need new reforms. There is a legal case to bring them back under public ownership. That and wartime economy, but there isn't political will. As we already discussed, political thinking is ideologically captured, and to execute politics that is contrary to the interest of the country, contrary to the interest of individual people. And you also mentioned some minority groups, disabled people, elderly, LGBTQI. So we know that those various groups that are for a combination of different reasons are socially and economically vulnerable, they again will be at the mercy and dependent on the grace of those willing to individually help them, you know, and for, like, international donations and volunteers. I do not see serious infrastructural, structural, and financial scaffolding in the current nor proposed policies that would secure them, guarantee them decent quality of life. I simply don't see that. And that is a tragedy, because we know that it is possible to have prosperity without destroying the planet. If we prioritize low carbon industries, if we prioritize care economy, looking after environment, create jobs there, looking after the only planet we've got, looking after each other, there can be monetary exchange, there can be goods and services that we actually need provided and produced. And access can be redistributed to individuals, groups, and countries that are in need through international solidarity frameworks. Then we can have some sort of chance in Ukraine and elsewhere. But before that kind of radical shift in thinking and looking past the divisive class politics that are pushing us internationally happens, I'm very worried about kind of politics that these divisions are bringing into us. And of course, socioeconomic deprivation always brings the worst into people. It's very difficult to feel solidaristic if you can't feed your children. And this is something that we need to together fight against, including and one of the key fights, of course, is writing off of debts internationally that cripple even the most well-meaning government's ability to support the basic needs of their populations.
Thank you, Yulia. Eric, I wanted to pose a question that came in from the audience to you, as well as one that I wanted to raise as that's connected to it. A viewer asked, who's the actual holder of the debt on Ukraine? How does it break down by IMF, World Bank, different countries? Who are the holders of the debt? The US, the European Union? And connected to that, I'm just reflecting on what you were saying about Ukraine and what Sushaban said is it's caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. Russian military imperialism and the economic imperialism of the US and the European Union. And connected to that, I just wonder about the kind of rehabilitation of the European Union, the European Central Bank, after the catastrophe they wrought in Greece. And they seem to be part and parcel of doing something as equally devastating in Ukraine. So who are the holders of the debt, and is there criticism that can be mounted against the European Union, the IMF, and World Bank to puncture the illusions in any kind of in the economic arms of Western imperialism?
Okay. So the IMF, the World Bank, and the European Bank for Investment, they have something in total more than 20 billion of the Ukraine external debt. You have the countries of the European Union as bilateral creditors, Germany, France, Italy. You have the European Commission through a plan of assistance to Ukraine. You have the as bilateral the USA. You have China. It is not exactly clear the amount due to China, but I think it's around $5 billion. Russia, something $3 billion dollars, and you have private bond holders, BlackRock. BlackRock is the main investor in Ukrainian external bonds, sovereign bonds. But there are other investment funds and banks. So that I am producing, writing an article of the on the situation, and I will give what I can find as exact figures. It's important to say that, you know, I mentioned that there is a suspension of payment until 2027, but there is an exception for the IMF and the World Bank. The payment to the IMF and the World Bank are keeping on, because the IMF and the World Bank maintain that their seniority as creditor. So the IMF has invented a form of maintaining the reimbursement to him without asking Ukraine directly to pay. So I explain that the IMF is made an agreement with the G7, and the European allies of the G7 inside the IMF, so Belgium, the Netherlands, Lithuania, and Finlandia, and others, and these countries are giving money to the IMF through a trust fund to pay back what Ukraine should pay to the IMF. So that's money who are not going to the Ukraine people. That's money who given by this country to a trust fund created by the IMF, in which the IMF is taking the money to reimburse what Ukraine should reimburse to the IMF. And the same with the World Bank. It's totally scandalous. So in my next article, you will see the list of the payment to the IMF quarterly by quarterly in 2022, 23, 24, 25, 27. Just also to say that Julia was speaking about the energy crisis. And what is also important is to say that the expenses of the European Commission in front of the energy crisis of 2020, 2022, and beginning of 2023 is 10 times the loans given to Ukraine. And this money to confront the energy crisis is clearly given to the big corporation, and that the part of the explanation of the super profits of the big Western corporation who are exploiting gas and oil. So it's also important to mention for the European public opinion that the European Commission is presenting itself like somebody who is generous for the people suffering for the Russian invasion. But in reality, that's pure rhetoric. In reality, that's loan to Ukraine, more debt for the Ukrainian people, and gift for the big corporation of the energy sector in Europe. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eric. I wanted to pose a question to Sushovan, because when you look at the situation of Ukraine, it's subject to military invasion, it's subject to Western economic imperialism, and you would think that there would be, you know, a spontaneous sentiment in the global South of identification with Ukraine's struggle for liberation and against debt. But as we've seen, there's an enormous debate within the global South governments and people about Ukraine and whether it should be supported in its struggle for liberation. Michael Karadzis laid this out in a really important article that was recently reprinted on Commons, where he showed the gap between what the governments are saying and what the people are thinking. And I think all of this is important in the run-up to the BRICS summit, which is going to be happening in South Africa later this year, where a lot of the governmental representatives have taken an either neutral or somewhat uncritical posture towards the Russian invasion and haven't expressed solidarity with Ukraine. So I just wanted to get you to comment a little bit about the debate, what you think should be advocated from the position of the Global South vis-a-vis Ukraine.
I mean, there are very complicated debates which are going on at this point of time. For example, I can tell you about India, which has not openly opposed the Russian invasion. It's not gone into the Russian camp very openly. It's quite ambivalent about it. It has been buying Russian oil at a very cheap price. So it's taken every advantage that it could take of the war. And minded that all connects us to all climate things, who enjoys the oil in India and things of that sort. Anyway, number two, in fact, it's very difficult to deal the thing in the BRICS because you have China and Russia as very strong blocks. So I don't think that BRICS is going to take a position. And I think that the BRICS is going to more or less toe the Putin and Xi Jinping line. They will not go like in G20, where the Russian representative was condemned and things happened that way. In G20, it's more the way the Western governments dominate. So these are different pedestals on different sort of wars, diplomatic wars around the Ukrainian invasion are being played out with very ambivalent positions of different countries. That's one. Number two, globally, of course, there is a huge solidarity with the with the Ukrainian people. But there's also a sort of, because, you know, over the years, the whole Western imperialism, as it has created precedents in many parts of the world, including the whole Arab world, including much of Asia, Southeast Asia, Latin America. So there's a reaction to it. Unfortunately, the Ukrainian people are just getting hostage to that reaction, which may not be ill-meant, but certainly ill-directed, no question about it, at this point of time. Much of the whole progressive leftist law. Third point is there's a huge amount of confusion within the left. Some of them see, it's not good to take name, but we know them. Some of them essentially defend Russian position and put every blame on the NATO expansion and the US imperialism and the Western imperialism led by the United States. It's very shameful at level to see people supporting war, especially notable people, well-meaning people from the left, who are otherwise in solidarity with many struggles around the world. But these are the same sort of people who are supporting Russia, who are also supporting Chinese loans in Africa. So, you know, so there are different logic. So it's a very complicated thing. And the saner progressive voice is very, very, very less at this point of time all across the world. There is a general sense of solidarity with the Ukrainian people, but there's always a danger that does not turn into a Russophobia, especially in Western Europe and other parts of the globe. So it's a very tightrope walking, you know. At one level, we oppose the Chinese ambitions of Chinese imperialist expansion, but we are also careful that doesn't turn into a xenophobia once again. So this is the whole range of things where it's very difficult to explain the situation to each and everyone. But certainly this is a major task of the global solidarity movement, as many of you have been doing.
Thank you, Sushovan. I just have one final question that I wanted to pose to Yulia, which is about the resistance within Ukraine to the debt and the neoliberal terms of the projected reconstruction. Because we've read about the trade unions in the country trying to resist Zelensky's restriction of labor rights, but can you give us a sense of the awareness of regular people about the kinds of problems of debt and neoliberal reconstruction and the potential for resistance to it, even within the war conditions that people are suffering through?
Thank you very much. This is a very important question indeed, because you know, the whole the issue of debt in Ukraine, as Eric very eloquently told us, it's not new. You know, it's a problem that that has been accumulated and aggravated over the years. It first became an all-national scandal when the global financial crisis finally reached Ukraine. It was like already in 2009, and this kind of the hardcore imposition of conditionalities wholesale came with IMF and restructuring of different sectors, tricks with the 3x devaluation of currency, you name it. So what IMF is quite familiar to an average Ukrainian, and that they come with conditions and with the whip. Indeed, the comedy that one of the many roles that Zelensky played, but the one that sort of like played into his presidential electoral campaign, in the comedy he played the teacher, the comedy was called Servant of the People, and he played the teacher who openly was talking against this, you know, IMF whip in Ukraine. So if it gets to the point of that kind of trope, you get an idea how familiar people are with what role IMF plays. But there is also a very strong understanding of the restrictions and the straitjacket in which policymakers in Ukraine are because of those conditionalities. A few of my friends are doing interviews with internally displaced persons and with refugees. And some of the stories that kind of lead to me through that is that there is a very clear understanding of who is the aggressor in this war. There is a very clear understanding of who oligarchs are and what their role is. There is a very clear understanding that, yes, U.S. also played their role in all of this. And yes, we don't like NATO, but we need NATO weapons. There is very clear material understanding of all of these complex things that we dress in theoretical language. It's fantastic to see how much clearer that average person's understanding is than of some of our of people who we used to call comrades before this war started. You know, it's much clearer to an average Ukrainian and to grannies and grandpas on the front line what's going on. It comes from them in their interviews. Right, they actually see things clearly, but they also understand the restrictions, that if you break those relations, it's a collapse of trade relations, it's a collapse of all sorts of different things. So there is a very sober view of what is at stake, right? So, but there is an understanding that this is wrong, there is an understanding that it needs to change, there is a very strong political demand. There is a very strong popular demand for an alternative political force. There are indeed a lot of activists and organizations. There are anarchists, there are socialists, there are feminists, LGBTQI activists, who actually were also very, very instrumental in helping internally displaced persons during especially the first waves of displacement and later. About different policies that need to be fought for, about what kind of needs to change, and that debt conditionality needs to end as well, and that the household indebtedness is also part of irresponsible and criminal indeed extortion of policies and cuts. So there is that material understanding. There is, I often say this, that there is a popular demand for socialism whose name we don't say in Ukraine. If you look at, and why? Because of what Russia does with the narrative, right? It's not because all Ukrainians are right-wing. They're not, actually. It's what Russia did with Soviet legacy. And in these conditions of war, of let's make USSR reality again with our old brethren, of course you're going to be rejecting it. But if you ask people what they want social provision, they want state funding, they want what socialist public policy is, what economic policy is. And they understand for that, that IMF comes with the whip, they understand that that the West has its economic interest and they are trying to plunder the country. They also know that the oligarchs are playing the same game, just, you know, under a different flag with a number of different passports as they like to have. So there are groups that are fighting for it. Like, you know, the group that I'm part of, Socialny Ruch, we've been working with different political organizations and activist organizations around the world. And we've been working with people on this call on this, on the campaign to write off Ukrainian debt and also popularizing the narrative that Ukraine is just one of the many countries that is under the debt discipline and that we should be building solidarities with other working people around the world who are being extorted by private lenders and through and by international organizations. So there are campaigns, there is popular demand for this, and there are also political organizations like Sitsyami, overwhelmingly Sitsyami, who are working, building coalitions, popularizing the narrative in Ukraine and abroad, building solidarity so that this internationalist fight and movement it breaches the divides that are being pushed onto us through capitalist narratives and their dominance in the popular press, so that we can shed we can kick them out of our heads and then kick them out of our governments and take back the means of production and the planet so that we have it for ourselves.
Thank you so much, Yulia, and thank you to Sushovan and Eric as well. This was a wonderful panel. I just have a couple of closing thank yous and announcements that I wanted to make. First of all, I wanted to thank our sponsors, the Ukraine Solidarity Network in the United States, as well as Haymarket Books, and in particular, Sean Larson, who did the invaluable technical work that is often unappreciated by people around the world, but that's essential, without which we couldn't even function, as well as Amanda Lundberg, who did the captioning so that people with hearing difficulties can participate in the panel. And then just a final announcement from the Ukraine Solidarity Network in the United States. We will be sponsoring a speaking tour this coming September entitled Resisting Russian Imperialism, Ukraine's Struggle for Self-Determination, which will feature Alona Liasheva from Yulia Yurchenko's group, Socialny Ruch, and part of Commons Journal, as well as she will be joined by Ilya Budraitskis in New York and Chicago, and in the Bay Area by Ilya Matveev. That speaking tour will commence at the Socialism 2023 conference in Chicago. So if you want to see them live and in person, be there in Chicago at Socialism 2023, which Yulia was at last year, and then see them in Chicago, New York, and the Bay Area. And look forward to announcements from the Ukraine Solidarity Network for those events. And just another thanks to everybody who put this on and for our speakers and to all people who joined in and watched it. Have a good day, everyone.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.